Miss an interview? Listen to it now at 1043thefan.com. Brought to you by First Bank. You work hard for your business, so should your bank. Talk to a First Bank business specialist today. First Bank. Business banking for good. Member FDIC.
Time for our weekly visit with the one and only Joel Klatley, college football analyst for Fox Sports. He's presented by Audi Flatirons. He joins us now. Good morning, Joel. Say hello to Nick Ferguson.
What's up, Nick? How are you?
I'm doing well, Joe. How about yourself?
Hey, man. Can't complain. It's sitting in some 405 traffic. Oh, I love Southern California.
Hey, can you, so I'm watching ESPN the other day. ESPN.
And, I don't know why you would do that, but go ahead.
Well, here's the reason why. Because all of a sudden, there you are. And you're doing this big thing about, you're talking about, I think, a game against Baylor, and there's highlights of you, and there's you and Gary Barnett talking, and I didn't get a chance to hear because I just happened to look up at the screen, but it was like a 60-second spot. What was this whole thing about?
Well, so it's the 150th anniversary of college football, and so the college football, the National Football Foundation, who runs the College Football Hall of Fame, they're doing a big initiative. And so they asked a bunch of us to do, you know, these pieces for them. And so I always thought it was just for the NFF, and they have a big relationship with ESPN, and they're airing a lot of that content. So it's just, you know, stories of college football. And I told the story, which is not a flattering one, about my very first action in college football after coming back from minor league baseball, in which I was put in the game as a true freshman, kind of mop-up duty against Baylor, and proceeded to overthrow my first three passes. I was so excited, right? I mean, this is the field I had played on, or excuse me, dreamed of playing on my entire life as a kid, sitting in the stands, and there I was actually out on the field. And so I overthrew my first three passes. We punted the ball away, and I come back over to the sidelines, and I thought Coach Barnett would be like, you know, like, hey, you know, like, how was it? You know, like, congratulations, way to get it. He was very crabby, and he said, well, good thing we're not wearing white pants. And thanks, Coach. Yes, I understand. I went right back down my leg. But so I was telling, I told that story, and they've run with it. They put it online. They put it on their air. Everybody keeps texting me, like, did you go to ESPN? I'm like, no. No, I did not.
Well, okay, so that makes a lot more sense now. But yeah, it was like a big long piece, and it was really good. So props to you. Hey, when John Elway comes out and says yesterday, yeah, we're 0-4, but we're only a couple of plays away from being 2-2 or better. We're close. Well, what's your reaction when John or anybody says we're only a couple plays away?
Well, he's not wrong, right? Because if you look at some of the other 0-4 teams, I think that they paint a very different picture than what the Broncos paint right now. But, you know, for example, Cincinnati has like a 53-point differential. They've scored 57, given up 110. Miami has a 137-point differential, just to give you some idea of what's going on. Meanwhile, within the West, the Raiders are sitting at 2-2. And they have a 23-point differential, and that's the exact same point differential that Denver has. So, you're wrong? No. I think of the teams that are winless, I think you can look at it and you can say, or you can infer at least, like, the Broncos are probably the closest team to competitive, if you want to say that, of the winless teams in the NFL. I don't know how much that makes you feel better about it or not, but is he wrong? Not necessarily. Think about some of these one possession games that they've had, and you can clearly get to a point where a snap here or there goes a different direction and you're 2-2. So no one wants to hear it, and he's going to get blasted for it, but he's not wrong.
Joe, we always hear about, you know, new coaches bringing in a different culture and establishing a certain level of leadership. But when we look at this Denver Broncos team and teams that you have been on, how important has the veteran leadership in the locker room been to establishing the culture that the coaches want to implement?
Well, that's a good question. I think culture is a very fickle thing. Chemistry, you know, team chemistry, this and that. And in this day and age, professional sports across the board in several different sports. I think it's nearly impossible to have a solid culture and what I would call quality chemistry if you're losing. The money is too big, which means that the risks are too great for injury, in particular if they're not going to mean anything as it relates to your own value for a postseason appearance. Think about Von Miller and the value that he got, not just in his contract, but also in outside marketing spots after the Super Bowl. You know, so once it's clear that your team is not going to be competitive, I think that the culture and the chemistry of a professional team falls apart immediately. This is not like a college team, you know, which I think is very different, and that culture can and will be built and continue to be built even through a rough season, because everybody is in that locker room is at least on equal footing, with the exception of maybe one or two guys that could have the potential to go on and play in the NFL after that, or in a professional league after that. So I tend to bristle a little bit when it comes to culture and professional sports. I think the culture in professional sports is about money. I think that the culture in professional sports is about, if we are good this year, then we're going to be all in, and then we're going to talk about how we're the underdogs and this is such a great group of guys and blah, 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 blah. But when you're losing, I don't think that there is one. So as far as whose responsibility is it in Denver with the Broncos, the responsibility lies with the front office. If you don't put a winner out there, then your culture in the locker room is not going to be all that good.
You grew up idolizing John Elway. What are your thoughts about him right now and the job that he's doing, well, and how hot is the seat that he should be on?
Yeah, I love the Duke. And I will defend him greatly because he has brought a Super Bowl and he brought a winner. Now the NFL currently is not made for sustained success. The model in the NFL is for 8-8. And there are times when you're going to fall below that, and then there are times when you're going to blip above that. And what we have been ruined by is Bill Belichick and Tom Brady, who have an unsustainable model where they're not paying a fair market value for the most important piece of their team. And they've established something that candidly probably won't ever be established again. And you look at any other organization, even Seattle in this midst, in the midst of having Russell Wilson, has dipped and ebbed and flowed. Aaron Rodgers has dipped and ebbed and flowed. Now, if you have a quarterback, you've got a great possibility of being above that 8-8 mark. So until Elway finds the above 8-8 quarterback, I think that is it his fault? Yes, I guess it kind of is, but isn't this what the league is made for? Isn't this how the league is built? I'm not trying to defend him. I'm just saying, like, this roster is not great, but at times in the cyclical nature of how rosters are built and made and contracts and the CBA and the salary cap, this is going to happen every once in a while. And I think that we've been ruined by New England, in particular in Denver, having competed for Super Bowls to such a great deal of success over the last, 20 to 25 years. I would say that it's frustrating, yes, certainly, but this is how the NFL is built. I mean, just ask all the other teams across the league.
So, Joe, based on that and the understanding that the league isn't built for sustained success over long periods of time, at this stage in the game, if you are John Elway, do you start to contemplate the idea of moving some valuable pieces on your team to accumulate draft picks for next year?
It just depends on what those pieces are, how much you're saving, how much you feel like they could contribute and be central pieces for what you've got the next 2-3 years, what you think your championship window is. But yes, overall, I do feel like if you look at the way the most successful organizations in the last 10 years have built themselves a competitor outside of Denver, really, who did it via free agency, what you see is a lot of draft and development. And in particular, because of the finances involved with the draft and development model, it leaves a lot there as far as money is concerned, because that's cheap labor as it relates to the rest of the league and in particular veterans. So do I think that that's the direction that they should go? Yeah, probably.
Vizzy with Joel Klatty's presented by Audi Flatirons. Now, Joel, you, and I mean this sincerely, you do a very good job of taking complex issues, offensive plays and everything, and breaking it down in a way that's very understandable. I'm going to challenge you with one here. Your thoughts, and kind of articulate in a way we can all understand, your reaction to the Fair Pay to Play Act, which was signed into law Monday and states that colleges in California cannot punish their athletes for collecting endorsement money. Is this a good thing?
It is a good thing. So here's the deal. This is not, and it's actually, the name of it is I don't want to say misleading, but it's not a great name, because people will immediately jump to this is pay for play, that these are going to be employees. And as soon as you start down that road about, well, does this mean the school has to pay these players? And are we going to treat them as professional athletes? Well, then what happens is Title IX gets kicked in. Now you've got to pay everybody in the athletic department. And that's unsustainable. There isn't enough money to do that across all sports. And I think that you would see the actual foundation of college athletics crack and fall apart. This is not that. And they're arguing that it is from the NCAA standpoint, but it's incredibly misleading from their standpoint. So here's what it is. It is strictly a name, image, and likeness deal. Okay, so right now, in order to have a scholarship in college athletics, you've got to sign away your name, image, and likeness completely. And holy. And I believe that that's wrong. Everybody else, every other student on the campus, and this is one of those things that they're always trying to make your life similar to that of a life of a regular student. But that student has his own or her own rights to their name, image, and likeness. So getting those rights back into the hands of the players individually, I think, is a good thing. Now, how you do that, it's a very difficult thing, because what are the parameters? Is it going to be the Wild West? Do we have agents involved? There's obviously tax liabilities now that will come on these athletes, so on and so forth. The bottom line, to try to sum all of this up, is it right to give the name, image, and likeness back to the persons whose name, image, and likeness you're using? Yes, it is a good thing. The Olympic model is much more the model that college athletes, athletics should start going towards. And that is what this is doing. Now, the Fair to Play Act, or whatever you want to call it, it doesn't actually start until 2023. So this legislation from the state, by the way, there are several states around the country that are following suit, including South Carolina, including Colorado, and this, their next legislative period. These are shots across the bow for the NCAA. It's basically saying, if you don't change by 2023, then we're going to change you from the outside in. And if that happens, college athletics is in big trouble. So the NCAA has had ample amount of time since the Ed O'Bannon case to change, reform, try to do things and implement things that will make people happy from the outside looking in. They have not done that. They've buried their head in the sand. And now state legislators and politicians are getting involved and shooting these shots across the bow to say, hey, you better change. And you better change quickly. Last thing I would say is this is one of the most bipartisan issues that we have in our entire country. Okay, when you look at, you know, it's kind of Democratic-led in California. It's Republican-led in South Carolina. There's one in the House Ways and Means Committee that is Republican-led. To get Republicans and Democrats on the same page in this climate is nearly impossible. It's like, the NCAA is like the warm toilet seat of society. It's the only thing everybody can agree upon that everyone hates. Like, I don't understand what they are trying to do or pull as far as trying to fight this. Because, again, overwhelming, unanimous, bipartisan support, and they're sitting there and being like, wow, we can't do this. Well, yes, you can. Figure it out.
The warm toilet seat. Man, nobody describes it like you do. Honest question, but how would it actually happen? Okay, so for example,
yeah,
Joel Klatt is a stud quarterback at the University of Colorado, and he's going to start to capitalize on his likeness and name. How does that happen? Who does that for you? Are you the one that's that? I mean, how does it actually get applied?
That's what they've got to figure out, right? And if I were in the room and trying to make this happen, this is what I would do. There would be deals that I would say, fall outside of the purview of the NCAA, and those are generally in sports that are non-revenue sports. So let's say you're a soccer player or a golfer or a tennis player, you know, male or female at any college in America, and your neighbor has a kid that plays that sport and you want to give lessons and they want to hire you to give lessons or do a camp, you should be able to do that, period. You should just be able to do that, and you should be able to make money based on the fact that you're an athlete because you are an athlete and it's your name and you can go give lessons. If someone wants to do an autograph signing or so on, you should be able to do that. If someone wants to be an Instagram influencer, you should be able to do that. Then there's going to be things that fall what I would deem under the purview of what I would think needs to be a centralized marketing arm of the NCAA. If I was building it, what I would do is I would have a centralized marketing arm. That marketing department or company, if you will then establish the market value for every player in America. Okay, because here's the underlying thing as well. These players are going to learn quickly that these marketing dollars are not copious in the amounts that they're going to get out there. In fact, if you actually unload this to the free market, what athletes will start to realize, and this is what rookies realize in every sport professionally across the board, is your value is very little, actually. You know, kids are not generally going to be going out there making hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars. Now, a couple will. But, you know, Zion Williamson maybe will, or Kyler Murray when he was at Oklahoma, he maybe will. But in general, the value is not there. So start with the centralized marketing department that's going to establish the Q score or market value for every player in America. If a company wants to go in and pay that player, then they would have to contact that marketing arm. Within the compliance offices in every school in America who deals with the rules and regulations of the NCAA, I would add one more position. That position would be a certified agent. That agent will then work with the marketing department, which is centralized, and the company that wants to pay a player, and then they can enter into an agreement that is above board and everybody understands it. It's not a shady agent from the side, so on and so forth. We can put parameters on how much can be accepted from a local market, how much can be accepted from a national market. That will help competitive balance across the country. And once we do that, then that agent within the compliance office on the campus can help with things like schedule, so you're not doing a photo shoot during class, or they're not going to have some sort of marketing appearance during a practice, so on and so forth. So that's a way. Now, again, you'd have to continue to hash this out to a greater degree, but that is a way to do this that would get these legislators at the state level and even the federal level off of their back. And that's all the legislators want to do, is to try to get them to move, get them to get their heads out of the sand, give the name, image, and likeness back to these athletes, and go from there. And here's the last point I would make. People automatically just go to football and men's basketball. And yes, this is certainly where it will affect the sport the most. But I would argue that it would be great for college athletics across the board, including the Olympic sports. You'd have players like Jeremy Bloom be able to continue to play football. You'd have swimmers like Katie Ledecky, who would be able to stay at Stanford, swim for Stanford, and continue to train for the Olympics rather than having to turn pro, leave Stanford, which is not good for college athletics. Think of the gymnast at UCLA that's getting fame. She could stay at UCLA and continue to monetize her most valuable period of life. I would even go to Michael Phelps. He could have stayed at Michigan. How can you argue that it's better to college athletics so that they can earn a living versus creating the avenues for them to make that living while staying in college athletics?
All right, let me just jump in.
A Titleist deal and stay in Texas, so on and so forth. I mean, it's just a no-brainer.
I know we got a break. I got the Huff yelling at me, but I got to ask you this. Will it cause problems when it comes to recruiting? Somebody texted in, what about the five-star recruit, the guy that owns the dealership will pay you $10,000 for your autograph, and then only the rich and big booster schools will be the ones that are getting the big recruits?
You think that's not already happening? I'm sorry. You think everything's above the board right now? I actually think that this would curtail some of the shady stuff that happens in recruitings. And the reason is because it would be above the board. You would actually have a paper trail. Yeah. You think kids are not getting money right now? Let me just tell you this right now. The five-star rate across the country in the underground is $300,000.
All right, so meaning the five-star recruits out there are getting $300,000.
Yeah, generally. So if you think that this is not already happening, I think that you're crazy.
Okay.
And it's like, well, do you think five-star kids are going anywhere except for Ohio State, Alabama, and Clemson as it stands, and Georgia? So, like, what? affect the competitive balance. It's already affected.
Well said, Joel. Hey, and I mean this in all sincerity, as this thing starts to get applied, you should be in the room. Thank you very much, pal. All right, there he goes, Joel Klatt, brought to us by Audi Flatirons.
You work hard for your business. So should we. That's why First Bank offers commercial real estate loans, business lines of credit, and online cash management solutions. With tools and services designed to make your business run easier, your day could have less this and more this. Visit eFirstBank.com/business to learn more. First Bank, business banking for good. Member FDIC. First
Bank. Banking for good.